Welcome to the Global Minnesota Podcast, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesota with the world. Our mission is to advance international understanding and engagement in every corner of the state. We do this with a variety of programs, including our public events, K-12 education programs, Great Decisions discussion groups, and professional exchanges. To learn more, visit our website at globalminnesota.org. I'm Nicholas Hayen, Marketing and Communications Manager for Global Minnesota. On January 31st, Global Minnesota hosted our popular annual event, the U.S. Foreign Policy Update. In this event, diplomat-in-residence and retired career Foreign Service Officer Tom Hansen discussed the latest foreign policy developments, trends, and challenges facing the U.S. this year. His insightful and wide-ranging discussion included topics like the repercussions from the ongoing war in Ukraine, concerns facing China's economy, renewed conflicts in the Middle East, and ongoing global struggles for peace and security. The full event recording is now available to watch at globalminnesota.org, or you can listen to it now on our latest podcast episode. Today's episode is a follow-up conversation with Tom Hansen, featuring questions that were submitted during the event. We received numerous questions for the special Q&A episode, and I've compiled a wide-ranging sample so we can hear more of Tom's unique analysis on all things foreign policy. So Tom, thanks for a thought-provoking event earlier this year and for joining the podcast today to answer our many questions that we have for you.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed the event at the end of January, and a lot has happened since then. So I'm looking forward to hearing the questions that came from the audience.
Yeah. So as you said, it's been a little over a month since we gathered with nearly 400 virtual and in-person guests for your presentation. So let's start off on that note. What major developments in foreign policy have happened since then?
Well, there's been a lot right across the board. I would focus on just a few. Obviously, Ukraine, in a nutshell, the tide is turning on the ground in Russia's favor, even more than when we met a month or so ago. And we maybe can talk about that in more detail later. The basic issue is that US and NATO are now contemplating very risky strategies to try to offset the Russian advantage on the ground. And so that's, I think, a key development that's happened. On the bright side, Sweden now is coming into NATO finally. Both Turkey and Sweden in the last few weeks now have lifted their a blockage of Swedish membership.
Hungary and Turkey
for Swedish membership. And so that's a positive thing. And then obviously, the key area is Gaza, and maybe this is a time to say a few things about that. The basic goal is to, tamp down the conflict, get a ceasefire at some point, prevent escalation into a regional conflict. And all this is proving very difficult. There's so much trauma on both sides, current trauma and past trauma. October 7th was a horrific event. Inexcusable. And of course, now we've had over 30,000 deaths in Gaza. So the Biden administration is trying to press for a ceasefire, but the signs right now are not good. Hamas has come back and said that even for a temporary ceasefire, they need an agreement that all Israeli forces will withdraw from Gaza. And of course, the Israelis are not about to give that kind of an assurance. We're at an impasse. And also the Biden team has made it increasingly clear that it wants some form of ceasefire now. Both the president and Kamala Harris have been very clear on that increasingly in recent weeks. We need to have some kind of movement eventually on a two-state solution. And that's where, as I say, the Israelis are blocking. So the dangers of regional escalation are still there. I mean, the Houthis are undaunted. They're still disrupting shipping. There are rumors now that Israel may attempt to push Hezbollah away from the border with Israel in the north and push Hezbollah back up past the Litani River. That's the old Leontes River from antiquity. And in other words, push them north of Tyre, north of Sidon. And this, the goal here would be to allow the 10,000 Israeli residents of northern Gaza, northern Israel, to return to northern Israel. So whether this happens or not is still up in the air, but there are indications that Israel is moving troops, more troops, to the north. There have been increasing numbers of incidents along the border there. So this really bears watching, because even though Iran seems to not want an escalation of the conflict and is pressuring its allies to be somewhat cautious, an outright incursion into Lebanon, it would be a very unpredictable act, and it would be very hard to know what would result from that.
I imagine that would be a fairly dramatic increase in hostilities, wouldn't it? Because Hezbollah has quite a large military force, and it'd be interesting to see what the United States would do in response to that. I imagine there's quite a bit of hesitancy towards Israel going into that incursion right now from the United States perspective, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And in fact, the way we fully embraced the Israelis since October 7th, providing all the military aid, actually at great expense to our standing in much of the world, for better or worse, and actually possibly in a way that's going to impact the election, our election in November 2024, because there's a lot of opposition to that policy. But the idea was to side with the Israelis and then use that to influence them, to have credibility. And so the Biden administration has said that one area where that did work was that we were able to dissuade the Israelis at the outset to not take aggressive actions up along the border with Lebanon. Yeah. And so, in other words, there have been skirmishes, but there hasn't been any full-on attack. And so that's what might be changing now, potentially.
And you did allude to that this could cause certain issues for domestic elections. As you said during your presentation, 2024 is being called the year of elections, with more people going to the polls across the globe than at any point in history. So what have been the results of these elections so far? And as we look towards the rest of the year, what should people be paying attention to as these elections are taking place?
It is, depending on how you define a democratic election, which of course is, there are many asterisks, but yes, an unprecedented year. It's estimated up to 3 billion people will be going to the polls. The elections that have taken place so far have been significant. The Taiwan election on January 13th, which was seen as a possible flashpoint if the sort of pro-independence forces had a very strong showing, that might have increased tensions with China. And in fact, it was a mixed result. And so some people feel that this actually has tamped down the pressures a bit. So that was a positive result. There have been examples of managed democracies having elections. Pakistan probably is the most clear example. On February 8th, they had an election, and the opposition candidate, Imran Khan, who is in prison right now, he's a former prime minister himself, his party came out ahead in the parliamentary vote, but under the influence of the Pakistani military, obviously the Electoral Commission of Pakistan made some decisions that allowed the current prime minister, Shahbaz Sharif, to return to power. And it was clearly a managed result. And so there's a lot of tension right now in Pakistan over that. Another managed election is coming up now in Russia. They will vote March 15th to 17th. Obviously, Putin will win. But there was and I mentioned this in the speech on January 31st, a peace candidate who arose, Boris Nadezhdin, who seemed to be getting a fair amount of support. People were lining up in the cold to make sure he had enough signatures to go on the ballot. And of course, lo and behold, once again, an electoral commission, that seems to be pretty important nowadays in managed democracies, determined that a certain percentage, I think 15% of his signatures, had to be disqualified for various reasons, and therefore he could not be on the ballot. That plus, of course, now the Navalny death and observances in Moscow, there is some degree of discontent in Russia right now, but it doesn't show up in the polls. Putin still has strong support, And he's obviously going to be the winner going forward. Now, Mexico is an interesting election coming up on June 2nd. You know, López Obrador is finishing his second term and thus will leave office. And two women, two very educated women, are vying as the top candidates. Claudia Sheinbaum, who is a physicist and former mayor of Mexico City, and who is a strong supporter of López Obrador, is leading handily and will most likely win the election and continue the Morena Party's dominance of politics. Her opponent, she's actually indigenous Mexican. She's a tech entrepreneur, and she's the second leading candidate. That will be an interesting election to follow as well. I would also mention, and this is not a national election, but the European Union is having an election for their parliament also in June. The European Parliament is still, doesn't have as much influence as the national parliaments, but it's getting more and more responsibility within the EU system. And it's often seen as the bellwether for the politics in the European Union. And this year, it will be a clear bellwether for populist parties who are expected to do well, largely on the basis of the immigration issue, which obviously we may talk about that a bit later, is a key factor.
This is populist parties from the far right or far left or both?
Both. For example, Germany right now has two rapidly rising parties, one on the left, one on the right, both having questions on immigration and also on EU and NATO. Especially from the right, it's mostly the Le Pen's party is expected to do quite well as well in France. That's another election to bear watching. Other ones coming up, you have South Africa on May 29th, Croatia, Georgia, some of the smaller European countries. And of course, the big one is our election, which is being watched with increasing trepidation around the world because obviously, since we're still very much at the center of global politics, what happens here will have a huge impact around the world, especially on our NATO allies, potentially. As I pointed out on January 31st, the Council on Foreign Relations, which issues a risk report every year, and our election was the number one risk in their assessment this year.
Yeah,
ahead of Gaza, ahead of Ukraine. So, it's in our hands to see, to make sure that this goes forward peacefully and we stay on an even keel. So anyway, those are the basic contests that have taken place and that are looming now.
And is there still question about if Ukraine will be having a presidential election this year?
It's pretty clear that they will not. And when we talk about Ukraine, maybe a little more in detail later, Zelensky has pretty much announced that in wartime, a lot of normal democratic procedures are suspended. Mm-hmm. That's actually a source of criticism, especially from some of our European allies about what's happening in Ukraine. But, you know, it's a horrible war, and that often happens in wartime. There are signs of tensions within governance in Ukraine, and there may be a push for an election coming up, depending on whether Zelensky is further weakened. As of now, they will not be holding an election.
And we did, unsurprisingly, receive a lot of questions about the war in Ukraine. So I guess the big one is just, how do you see this conflict ending?
Well, I mean, we're not there yet. There's a lot that will take place, which I'll try to describe here. But In a nutshell, I fear that the most likely ending is some form of frozen conflict, in which Russia retains the real estate they have right now, and perhaps a bit more. I think they would like to move on and take Kharkiv, the second largest city, which is in great peril right now, and perhaps even attempt to take Odessa down in the south, which would be a bigger prize, but also more difficult to attain. And the only scenario where this would happen would be if the scale of losses and on both sides, a kind of an exhaustion, including on both sides militarily, but also among supporters in the West, that finally it just grinds to a tragic halt. with a number of issues unresolved, the thought that, some form of negotiations would take place. Of course, that was the idea with Korea too, and Korea has remained a frozen conflict. There are many frozen conflicts in the world, and this could become one of them. But that's not, I think that's the most likely, but it's not necessarily, because there are many shoes left to drop here.
Yeah, and just circling back on, you mentioned Odessa. So the importance of that would be essentially to landlock Ukraine and to take the remaining coastline away from it, is that correct?
Correct. And also Odessa has been a Russian-speaking city, largely. There was violence there right after the change of government back in 2014. And so, you know, in general, Russia is trying to assimilate the Russian-speaking portions of Ukraine. In other words, the parts of eastern Ukraine, which voted for Yanukovych in the last election before 2014, which historically have been part of Russia, where you have the Orthodox faith predominant. You know, Western Ukraine, even into central Ukraine, has a very different history. And so I think that the Russians probably, I'm skeptical that the Russians really intend to, I may be wrong, move much further beyond acquiring the territory they have in a bit more. I think that they would like to stabilize that and kind of have a dysfunctional Ukraine that would continue, because to try to go in and occupy and stabilize Western Ukraine, given the differences and given the very high degree of anti-Russian feeling in Western Ukraine, I think would be a bridge too far. And to attack an Article 5 NATO country would also be a huge risk for Russia, which is in demographic decline. One-third of their economy now is devoted to the military with this war, and they increasingly declare that their priorities now are in the other direction. They see themselves more and more as a part of Eurasia. They call themselves Northern Eurasia. They see vast opportunities working with China, with Turkey, with Iran and Central Asia. Now, whether this is just propaganda, but this is the line, and this is what the Russian people are being told. That's why I think this idea of a frozen conflict makes sense, just because I don't think the Russians are going to push unless they're attacked directly. I don't see them now, but that is a possibility, and that's what I think we need to discuss, because the next stage of this conflict involves a lot of risk-taking potentially by the West.
Yeah, and because we have, in the West, we have provided quite a bit of support. Do you think that support would be enough? You know, can Ukraine acquire the necessary equipment it needs to win this war? Or is Ukraine just simply outnumbered and out-equipped for such a long-term war of attrition?
Well, you know, with the failure of the counteroffensive, and as this war has ground on, you know, Russia is pursuing a strategy of what you might call aggressive attrition. Mm-hmm. They're not really trying to take a lot of, when you're on the offense, you take higher losses. And so the Russians are being fairly careful. They're using their air power. They have total air dominance. They're trying to reduce Ukraine's air defenses, infrastructure, as we see. And so
Is that something that can be resolved with F-16s, or is it more complicated than that?
It's more complicated than that, because the problem is on the ground, and I'll expand this in a minute, but on the ground at least, this is turned into a World War I type conflict of trench warfare, in which artillery is really, and ammunition are key, and manpower. And the Russians have a tremendous advantage in both of those factors, obviously in population. And since the West has not geared up for this kind of war for decades, the U.S. and our allies are having to retool production to meet the ammunition needs of the Ukrainians. And for the moment, we're way behind the curve on that. Nothing is going to come in very soon. So, and of course, in Congress, further aid, for the moment at least, is blocked. So what you've had happen in the last couple months and even weeks is the two primary bastions that Ukraine had set up in Donbas since 2014. These are not just towns that fell. These are military bastions that finally fell to the Russians, Bakhmut and Avdiivka. And the defense lines between those bastions and the Dnieper River are very thin. And so there's talk I think what we're advising the Ukrainians now is to forget about offensives, get through the year 2024, go on the defensive. There's even talk about setting up an iron triangle around the Dnieper River as they potentially fall back. And then hope that that aid will be online, that we'll be able to supply Ukraine by 2025 in a way that would get them back in the game. But the problem is they're running out of personnel. It's estimated up to 1 million young Ukrainian males of draft age have fled into Europe, for example. Right, it's not just a lot of young Russians that left, a lot of young Ukrainians have left, and more are leaving right now because there are rumors of a call-up of up to 500,000 in Ukraine. Given that situation on the ground and the fact that these tensions have arisen in Ukraine about governance, and as you say, the elections are coming up, there's a discussion now in NATO of how we offset these disadvantages. The idea is to take the war to Russia as we're losing on the ground. So, and maybe go after, you know, depots, go after shipping in the Black Sea. And the problem is that some of these systems are so complex that they have to be actually managed by NATO personnel. And so, and Putin has given a speech, he gave his State of the Union address this week, in which he said very clearly, if we are struck on our territory by weapons that are provided and targeted, managed by NATO personnel, we will respond. What response that would take, what kind of escalation that would lead to is hard to know at this point, but NATO is seriously considering these steps. So it could, it's going to be a potentially dramatic going forward, given this discrepancy between sort of a negative trend on the ground and the need to somehow offset that in other ways.
All right, so shifting gears a bit, we received some questions about global migration. So, of course, global migration is projected to increase substantially in the coming years due to political instability, climate change, variety of other factors. How do you think this will shape global political movements in 2024 and beyond?
Well, as we've already alluded to in discussing the European Union elections, it's going to be, immigration is a huge factor in the domestic politics, especially in the West. You know, it's interesting that other parts of the world, for example, most of Asia, it's really not an issue because China, Japan don't really allow immigration that much, right? They have, they never have. And so a lot of the immigration that is arising out of the global South, out of Africa now with its burgeoning demographics, the destabilized zones in the Middle East, it's heading for Europe primarily and for the United States. Now, a certain fairly high percentage of immigration takes place within the country, right? I mean, about half of immigration takes the form of displacement, internal displacement.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like everything is coming our way. You know, there's been quite an increase just this past year now. The European Union had 1.1 million asylum seekers, 1.1 million in 2023. That's up almost 20%. From the previous year. It's the highest since 2015, which was that was the tsunami that took place where Angela Merkel said, you know, we can handle this. And of course they have handled it well, but there's more coming now. When it comes to Europe, the largest number coming in are Syrians. It's up almost 40%. Afghans, a lot of Afghans. More Turks are coming in. And then of course coming up, the irony of our military action in Libya, when we got rid of Gaddafi using responsibility to protect, but then continuing our assault, is that it's become a chaotic zone where immigration is free to flow up from Africa. And now that you have a number of anti-Western coups taking place, places like Niger, Niger, Mali, which are already under climate duress, countries like Niger have ceased all cooperation with the Europeans in terms of trying to stem immigration coming through. So there's a huge flow now that's developing. It'll be more and more climate change going forward. But right now, a lot of it is due to political instability. But also, you should never forget that immigration is based on push and pull factors, right? And so, you know, there are a lot of push factors that we've been describing, climate, chaos, from military corruption. But there's also the cell phone, People all around the world now can see a better life and participate in it virtually. And so the pull factor on immigration is also very strong now. So we'll see where this goes. And of course, our southern border, we've had an unprecedented number, I think 300,000 in December. A country to watch here is Germany, because 30% of all the immigrants coming up into Europe now are going to Germany. And the Munich Security Forum, which has an annual meeting, it had its meeting in March, sort of the world security and military elite, they always do a big study beforehand. And they found that the country that is under the most tension and where immigration is the greatest factor in politics is Germany right now. And so that's why the rise of the Alternative for Germany party, which is advocating not just stopping immigration, but sending masses of immigrants back to their countries, including immigrants that have become German citizens. And this is such a controversial policy that there are people calling for the party to be banned. But the problem is they've got over 20% right now of the vote. They've got nearly 40% in parts of East Germany. Do you ban a political movement, as questionable as it may be, if it has that degree of support in the electorate? And so Germany is under great stress there. And on the left, there's a new party headed by a very articulate former left party member named Sarah Wagenknecht, who her party is rapidly rising. The center parties, the Social Democrats, are sinking like a stone right now. Here at home, Donald Trump, after his victory on Super Tuesday, his speech was all about immigration.
Yeah,
it was a harsh, very forceful statement on the immigration issue, which I think here too will be a factor. And here too, you could argue that Ukraine is fading a bit in the popular discussion right now, coming up to that election. So, how do you handle immigration? Even if you accept that it's needed, you still have the question of how do you organize it? How do you? And that's what's really up for debate.
Yeah. What are some of the solutions that some of those parties are proposing? I mean, we've heard, of course, what like Alternative for Germany is proposing on the right. What is the counter argument on the left that's being proposed?
Well, I think that there is a on the left. In many Western countries, there's a sense that diversity is a strength. You know, there's a moral aspect of helping people in need. And then the argument that we're going to need the workers anyway. So, but even some of the left parties now in Germany, for example, are, and you've seen this in Scandinavia, where some of the parties were very open to immigration. And now in a country like Denmark, you know, even the Social Democratic parties have swung to a much stricter, of course, these are countries with small populations that, you know, where when large number of immigrants come in, it really has an impact. Canada's interesting because they've been trying to establish laws that will encourage educated immigrants. I mean, immigrants that clearly will contribute to the economy and to the community. I mean, however you define that. Whether you can really make that kind of a triage, I don't know. There's some discussion of that here, but I mean, everything is so blocked in Congress, and you know, I mean, it's clear that there's an attempt being made to kick the immigration issue down the road so that it will be a huge factor in our November election.
And you alluded to this a bit, but, you know, the African continent is going to be big, not just in this sense of immigration, but because the population growth is expected to rapidly outpace that of the rest of the world. So
correct.
Tell us what you see as the opportunities for U.S. engagement here throughout all of Africa.
Well, I mean, they're huge. I mean, there are 54 countries in Africa, huge resources, populations that are increasingly educated. The World Bank predicts now that among all the regions of the world, Africa will be number two in growth. They're going to be the second fastest growing part of the world. And 11 of the top 20 countries predicted for growth will be in Africa. Yeah. Now, obviously, they're starting many times from a lower level, right? And so you have to see that all in relative terms. But still, these are very encouraging signs. And other countries are finding tremendous opportunity and advantage. You know, China, obviously, with its Belt and Road extends into Africa. They are opening up the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa now. Six new countries came in last fall, and now there are 30 more waiting in line, some of them in Africa. South Africa is a very enthusiastic member of the BRICS. Russia is getting more and more involved. Turkey is very interested in Africa, building infrastructure. So there are tremendous opportunities. And the problem has been for us that just given the way our economy is organized, we cannot force the private sector to go in to take economic risks anywhere, right? We used to have a more active aid program in the 60s into the 70s, but that's been pretty much defunded now. Obama had a year of Africa in his last year in office. Heads of major corporations in the US were there, and there was exhortation, okay, this is the future in many ways, let's get involved, and nothing happened. And the same thing, Biden organized rather hastily an African summit end of last year. The reason being that we discovered that apart from our allies in Europe and the G7, other countries out in the global south were not supporting us on Ukraine. They were demurring, ignoring sanctions. This, of course, is what has helped Russia to keep its economy relatively strong in spite of hobbling sanctions that we've. And so there's a sense now. So I think in Washington, we've awoken to the political importance of Africa, right? That increasingly the global south will be, or what the French and the Russians and the Chinese call the global majority, because it's going to have about 80 something percent of the population later in this century. We need to get involved, and we're trying to get involved. Kamala Harris has been traveling in Africa, but to get the economic engagement going is much more difficult. I mentioned at the end of January, and this idea that Zbigniew Brzezinski signaled in his final year, and that is that, yes, the global south will be more and more important, and there's a lingering resentment among all these former colonies toward the West that will become more and more manifest. And you're starting to see it. I think that's part of why we got so little support on Ukraine. That's why on Gaza, most of the developing world, the global south, is voting against us in the UN on Gaza issues. Joseph Borrell, just last week, you know, he's the head of the foreign policy establishment in the EU, said global south has growing influence. The era of Western dominance is over. Ukraine and Gaza signal the shift that's going on. And finally, this Munich security poll, which found a discrepancy in the West, they found great pessimism about the future. A lot of Western populations are worried about immigration, war, Ukraine, crime, all kinds of things like this, the economy. And in contrast, great optimism among many countries in the global south, where, yes, even though they're starting from a lower level, there are signs of things picking up, and where there's a very active trade environment developing, oftentimes under Chinese auspices.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think there's increasing signs that maybe because of Ukraine, people are awakening to the importance of Africa, and along with it, the global south. We are so focused on geopolitics now, right? That everything is seen in that prism. Even the way we're organizing our economy now with a greater emphasis on a national industrial policy, it's all about competing with China. It's all about the fact that they've gotten out ahead of us in certain technologies. The Africans, the developing world, they see this. They see us coming at them in a kind of a geopolitical struggle that they don't want to be part of anymore. This is not the Cold War. They don't want to be a non-aligned movement. They themselves are coming into a place in the sun. And so if we keep approaching them on this sort of semi-colonial geopolitical basis, we're going to get nowhere. China, they come at them in a very pragmatic way, you know, offering infrastructure, all sorts of things in exchange for access to resources and such. We have to up our game here, and I think a lot of younger Americans see that.
So, speaking of China, during your presentation, you mentioned that the U.S. relationship with China could provide unique opportunities for positive developments this year. Could you just expand on that a bit more, and tell us, like, what other prospects for stability and global prosperity do you see in 2024 and beyond?
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of those prospects will depend on how we manage our relations with countries like China, because it is a global economy now. And this is another example where geopolitics is often at odds with sustainability. And this is what I hear, once again, getting back to my students again, but I hear that all the time from them. For the new generation, sustainability is the key. That's the threat for their long lives ahead. A country like China is really pursuing a geoeconomic strategy. It's like we're playing checkers and chess, right? Hmm. They see their strength in economic relationships, economic structures at which they will be at the center. They're not opening bases around the world and expending a lot that way. They are spending to defend themselves in their immediate vicinity, and of course looking to Taiwan. But that's part of the problem. But the optimism. So I mentioned the Taiwan election, which I see as something that actually had a somewhat calming effect on the relationship. Apart from that, for whatever reason, the U.S. Decided to make overtures to China. This was in November when Biden met with Xi. And that unblocked a lot of areas of cooperation, which is part of the reason for my optimism, one being fentanyl. You know, the Chinese, the components of fentanyl come over from China. They're assembled and, you know, distributed by Mexican cartels. But we've tried again and again to get a handle on the components to make sure that they don't come in that way. And China was cooperating on that until Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. It's an example of geopolitics being linked to other issues. And the relationship really was in the deep freeze for about a year. And in November, it was decided to some extent, bury the hatchet and to cooperate more on fentanyl, on military to military contacts, which is very important for global stability, on climate. And this happened just before the climate meeting in Dubai. And so that was a plus there. Why did we do that? Well, I think on the one hand, we're kind of overburdened right now. When you look at all we've gotten into with Ukraine, with Gaza now, I mean, these are not going away anytime soon. We're very distracted. We don't want to overload the circuits right now with China, right? And so therefore, I think it was felt that let's reach a little more accommodation with China. You know, Blinken has gone to Beijing urging China to weigh in on our behalf with Russia, in the Middle East, with Iran, with whom China has very good relations. And I mean, it's an example of how we, having kind of eased up a bit with China now, we're hoping to engage them. You know, China is not going to abandon Russia, but they've been also very cautious on supporting Russia. So I guess this is what gives me some room for optimism, as I can see some U.S. strategic reasons for trying to keep things on an even keel. And Chinese definitely want to keep things. I mean, they say their number one priority actually is the U.S. and making sure that the relationship doesn't just totally deteriorate.
Yeah, I guess in looking at this, I'm reminded of studying the early Cold War, where the United States was very, very concerned, almost obsessed with the idea that Russia wanted to, or the Soviet Union wanted to expand everywhere and to be everywhere. And it was this overarching U.S. concern. But looking at the source material in the Soviet Union at the time, that's not really what they were concerned about. They were actually concerned about the United States doing essentially the same to them. And yeah. After several years, after almost a decade, eventually a detente emerged where both sides realized, I don't think that's actually what the other side wants. Do you think that a similar type of thing could be occurring with China and could be possible with China, especially as these rumors of a new Cold War begin to surface?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's the old security dilemma. That's what they call it, where actions that one country perceives as defensive are perceived by the other as offensive, and an escalation gets underway. And that's certainly been happening with China. So, as I say, they are pursuing more of a geoeconomic strategy. So I don't think that we feel challenged by their force projection out in the world the way we did with Russia, right? There was a sense that they would project force in many places. I mean, the Chinese have a small base in Djibouti, but everybody has a base in Djibouti, right? I mean, that's the way things are. Yeah. But as I say, they are focused on their immediate periphery, on Taiwan. And so that's the issue that we're going to have to manage, because for the Chinese, Taiwan is an unfinished civil war. Dating from World War II. And, you know, the U.S. Fifth Fleet did protect the Kuomintang forces that they fled from the Chinese mainland onto Taiwan. And China perceives, rightly or wrongly, that our interest in Taiwan, because we declared in the first year of Biden for the first time that Taiwan is a vital U.S. national security interest. I mean, the implications of that are we want to keep Taiwan as part of our security structure. And so it's at odds with the two China policy for sure. So China perceives that we're using Taiwan as a proxy to weaken them. And just as frankly, Russia considers what we're doing in Ukraine as a proxy war from their point of view, right? Rightly or wrongly, we perceive a lot of issues with democracy. Why should anybody tell the Taiwanese or the Ukrainians what they can and can't do? You know, I mean, we have arguments on our side too. It's the Taiwan issue we're going to have to wrestle with, I think, as we try to stabilize this relationship. So it's not going to be easy to stabilize this, and there'll be a lot of, as I say, misperceptions on both sides, threats, and like you say, during the Cold War, it finally got to the point where each side began to say, well, wait a minute, maybe the threat isn't as great as we thought. I mean, Russia was nowhere near as strong as we thought it was at the end. And my argument always is that there are graver threats right now out there than these geopolitical issues. I mean, everything to do with sustainability is going to require global cooperation. And to the extent that we can redefine the threats in a way where we see a joint interest with countries like China and making them a priority. And that's a little bit of what happened last November between Xi and Biden. So that's my hope.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining again, for your incredible insights. Really appreciate it.
A lot of this is in our hands, both in terms of our foreign policy and our domestic situation. I mean, in my view, we're spending $900 million on defense. That's necessary, but we've got to spend more on education. We need an educated workforce, which will solve so many things. We've got to get our inequality under control. It's in our hands. I guess that's what I would say. And so our country's always risen to the occasion in the past, and I believe it will again.
That's all the time we have today. Thanks again to Tom Hansen for joining and for his work to advance international understanding and engagement in Minnesota. If you want to catch the full video recording of the full event, the recording is available now on our podcast feed and at globalminnesota.org. Thanks as always to all the members of Global Minnesota who make our programs possible. Be sure to check out our website at globalminnesota.org to find information about upcoming events, learn more about our international programs, and sign up for our weekly newsletters. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already, so you can hear untold stories of international connections each month and catch recordings of our public events. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.